Hi, everyone. We have finally moved on from the Bonded Vault.
Finally, and I'm hoping we've also moved on from delays in posting our episodes.
I take the blame 110%. I am the problem child, not you.
Well, better the you than me.
Thanks a lot. Okay, before we get started, what questions are we answering this week?
Well, first of all, you need to answer the question about the Fifth Amendment.
Okay, so we were half right. If you have full immunity from the DOJ, you cannot plead the Fifth. If you have a limited immunity, then you are allowed to plead the Fifth if the question pertains to a crime not related to the one you've been granted immunity for.
Well, that makes sense, and it explains so many of the cases we've looked at.
Oh, yeah, for sure. One more thing before we hit the mailbag question of the week. Our next episode will be on May 13th. We're going to be on normal schedule.
Yes, we are back to our normal schedule, you guys.
Okay.
Blessed relief.
Let's move on. What's the question?
Okay. Well, I did want to answer this question from David about Winter Hill, since it ties in with two of the murders we'll be talking about in this episode. So his question was, were Joe Mack, Jimmy Sims, and Howie friends with Johnny Modorano and Stevie Flemmi?
Okay, so in my opinion, although they all knew each other and were technically all Winter Hill, I wouldn't call them friends.
There is no honor amongst thieves is all I have to say to that.
Our favorite cliche, amen to that. All right, before we begin telling the stories of the men who were slain in 1976, you also want to share a couple of things with us.
Okay, so just to set the stage, I want to note that former Special Agent John Keogh was serving as the Public Safety Commissioner of Massachusetts at the beginning of 76. For our listeners who don't know or don't remember, Keogh served in the Boston FBI field office with Special Agents H. Paul Rico and Dennis Condon starting in the 50s. Rico, as we've mentioned previously, was now in Miami, and Zip Connolly had taken over much of his caseload. As for Condon, he was a little over a year away from retirement. He'd eventually replace Keogh as public safety commissioner.
Okay. And on the not FBI side, you wanted to share something about Miles Connors?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay. Watch out. Miles might be watching, you know, and he's still kicking.
I highly doubt that, but okay.
You never know.
Well, it could happen. Okay. But I'm going to share some stuff for context here. On January 5th, 1976, Miles Connor was sentenced to 4 years for the theft of art from the Woolworth Estate in Monmouth, Maine.
Miles was also a believer in the power of the lamb, as he had jumped bail in the spring of 75.
Well, we have to call the Sunny Mercurio episode The Power of the Lamb.
For sure, it was his line, after all.
Okay, well, let's not get too sidetracked here. Now, many of our listeners probably know that Miles had reportedly stolen a Rembrandt from the MFA in Boston in April of 75. And for the Gardner Museum geeks like me, when the Rembrandt was stolen, the Gardner director Roland Hadley commented, quote, "You can't sell a Rembrandt. Nobody's going to buy the thing." Just
okay.
A little foreshadowing there.
Mm-hmm.
And Roland knew what he was talking about. 8 months later, the Rembrandt was still missing. However, Miles had been attempting to return the painting ever since he'd been arrested in September, but the feds didn't want to play ball. So, Miles went to State Police Major John Regan. He, along with Assistant U.S. Attorney, agreed to cut a deal with Miles. The two men drove to a restaurant parking lot, met a man in a ski mask who told them to go inside. After about 10 minutes, a phone call informed them to return to their car, where they found the Rembrandt wrapped in a sleeping bag in the trunk.
Another Netflix-worthy scene, if I've ever heard of one.
I know. Can you imagine?
And what was up with the stuff in the trunk? Richie always had paintings and Rodins wrapped in bed sheets and blankets in the trunk. I mean, how do you put all of this priceless artwork in your trunk?
I don't know, but that was the, like, transfer point. So it wasn't handed directly to them. When they went back to Regan's car, that's where the painting was left.
Yeah, but you know they were schlepping the thing around in the trunk still. I mean, how'd they get it there? It was in the trunk.
So
just
Miles,
another trunk.
Miles did all this from the Charles Street jail. I just want to point that out there.
Okay. Alrighty.
But the deal meant that Miles got sent to Walpole instead of doing a federal bid, which is what he would have gotten if he hadn't made this deal. So he was sent to Walpole on directly after sentencing.
Walpole was a happening place back in those days.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. All right. There will be more of Miles to come next season. Now, you also want to talk a little bit about Joe Mack, since we have the Winter Hill Redux coming soon.
Well, Joe Mack also believed in the power of the lamb.
Mm-hmm.
But I need to backtrack a bit here. On March 17th, 1971, two men robbed the Confederate... Tell me how to say this again.
Philately?
In Boston's Back Bay, filling two bags with over 400,000 stamps. The owner of the shop, Jack E. Molesworth, was conveniently away on vacation in Florida at the time. Joe Mack McDonald and Jimmy Sims were suspected of involvement in the crime.
Then in March of 1975, a California pharma executive named Edward Powell was arrested, and like magic, 75% of the stolen stamps were recovered. The interesting thing to me was that a large portion of the stamps were said to be counterfeit. Some of the remaining stamps that were in his newly acquired collection were from thefts at the Cardinal Spellman Museum in New York and Regis College. You have to figure Powell didn't actually steal anything, but was rather procuring these items in a not-above-board manner.
Well, that's exactly what the authorities alleged happened, and those other two thefts were committed by Phil Cresta and Ben Tilly's guys, who by this time had hooked up. Which just makes me wonder again about whether or not Ben Tilly's death was really an accident.
I will forever have questions.
But back in California, it turned out that a stamp dealer named Raymond Lundgren had led the feds to the stolen stamps. Lundgren and another dealer named Sammy Frudakis were the organizers of the Long Beach Coin and Stamp Exposition. They had run the annual event for over a decade. Both men were involved in the stolen stamp and coin scheme, along with several other dealers from around the country. The two men pleaded guilty in October, and Frudakis got a slap on the wrist, but Lundgren reportedly agreed to testify against Joe Mack and Jimmy Sims.
Mack went on the lam that same month, first hiding out in Chelsea, then to New York City, followed by the sunny beaches of Florida, with a detour in January to California.
And that's why we're talking about Joe Mack in this episode. He committed our first mob hit of the year. On January 13, 1976, McDonald killed Raymond Lundgren, the coin dealer who had led the authorities to the stamps 10 months earlier. Lundgren was shot four times at point-blank range with a .38 in front of his wife as they got out of their car at their condo in Sierra Madre, California. Joe Mack was added to the FBI's most wanted list the following month.
Mack and Sims will be back later in this episode. Let's move on to the first death of a mobster in Massachusetts in 1976, Frank Chi-Chi Cucciara. He and his wife were found dead in their Belmont home on January 23rd after calls from relatives went unanswered. He was 79 and she was 69 years old. There was no signs of forced entry and the home was locked from inside. It was deemed a murder-suicide. Let's talk a little bit about Chi-Chi, the original Cheese Man story.
Well, people who want to hear more of Frank's story should listen to our Founding Fathers episode that's linked in the show notes from season one. Frank was arrested 12 times over the years for a variety of offenses, including possession of morphine and dynamite at the same time in 1925, assault, conspiracy, illegal lottery, and auto violations. He was the only New England mobster who attended the famous Apalachin meeting in 1975. 1957. He was indicted for obstruction of justice after the meeting, but was acquitted in December of 59 in New York court.
I still want to know what he was doing with morphine and dynamite at the same time.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe has backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Time, but it's another one of those things that I'll never have the answer to. Frank was very well respected and one of the last of his generation. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, we had Joe Barbosa.
Well, we've done multiple episodes about Barbosa, and we've already covered his demise on February 11th of 1976 in San Francisco, California. So I don't really want to dedicate any more time to it.
I couldn't agree with you more. But Joseph J.R. Russo wasn't finished. Let's jump out of order here and cover the murder of Patrick J. Patsy Fabiano on March 31st. He was found slumped over in the front of his car in the North End. He had been shot 4 times in the head at close range. The authorities said there was a large sum of cash in his pockets.
Well, let's be clear that J.R. was never formally charged with Fabiano's killing, but the hit was always attributed to him. And since Fabiano was one of Barbosa's partners and corroborated some of Barbosa's testimony that led to Raymond Patriarca going to prison, it was believed that J.R. was the one responsible for the slayings of Barbosa and his other partners.
And they were Tosh Bratzos and Tommy DiPrisco in November of 1966.
We went into a lot of detail about their murders and Chico Amico's in December of that same year in the Hit Parade of 66, which I thought we did a really good job with. So check that out.
I think so, too. Right. And with the slaying of Fabiano, Nicky Femia became the last man standing.
I would not have wanted to be in his shoes. But he did survive another almost 8 years, and I don't think JR killed him.
Possibly.
But how much of Fabiano's backstory do you want to cover today?
I want to mention that in August of 67, Fabiano took the stand and alleged that two FBI agents, presumably Rico and Condon, visited him in jail and tried to pressure him to back up Barbosa's testimony. In exchange for Fabiano's testimony, they promised they would spring him and get the weapons charges against him dropped. That led to Fabiano's attorney's efforts to get a court order to block the feds from harassing Fabiano in jail. The authorities had put Fabiano in a hospital ward, not because he was sick or injured, but because they claimed his life was in danger.
Well, that wasn't a lie exactly. As we just mentioned, Tash Bratzos, Tommy DiPrisco, and Chico Amico had all been killed the previous year. But as far as the story that Fabiano was $100,000 in debt when he was killed, that seems questionable. Considering that he had all that cash on him, I think he was just a smokescreen. But he was doing real estate transactions, and I was thinking he might have been in on that HUD scam.
We will have to explore that when we get to the Howie Winter episode in a few weeks. There were more HUD scams going on that you could shake a stick at.
Well, was Richie into that too?
I don't think he was involved directly, but more than a few of the guys around him were. I was perplexed at first what the heck HUD was. I was little, you know.
Well, I'm sure you quickly figured it out.
Well, yeah, but it still took me a while. There was no internet back in those days.
Okay, let's get back to chronological order and the next victim, James F. Kearney, who was killed in
Billerica.
I swear you're deliberately giving these towns.
Would I do something like that to you?
Yes.
Well, all right, maybe I'm guilty as charged. All right, now please regale us with James Kearney's story.
Okay. Kearney's body was found on the side of the road on February 19th. He had been beaten so severely that he was unrecognizable, and identification was made based on his clothing and jewelry. The authorities speculated that he had been beaten elsewhere, then driven to the location where his body was discovered and shot twice in the forehead to finish him off. The cops found $1,400 on him, so robbery was ruled out as a motive. They described the 46-year-old as a loner and said he was working as an independent bookie.
The theory that the authorities floated around was that Kearney had offended someone. This former Somerville man was believed to have been killed by two of his associates who were also from Somerville.
Well, that just makes me think of Stevie, Frankie, Whitey, and Howie.
Well, me too, but his murder remains unsolved, so maybe it was someone on the fringe.
Well, you know I want to be snarky and say, or none of them could remember killing him.
All right, don't get me started. Before we wrap up Kearney, let's talk briefly about his background.
Okay, well, you know I love bank robberies, so that's where I'm heading. In May of 66, the New England Merchants National Bank was robbed of $53,106. Less than a week later, Kearney was arrested and held on $50,000 bail. The two other men, Anthony Battaglia and Harry Argyris, were also arrested after being identified by bank employees. Argyris had been a security guard at the bank and confessed to his involvement almost right away. He claimed that he had been threatened into participating by the others.
Well, your favorite judge, Felix Forte, presided over the case. Good old Ronnie Chisholm defended Argyris, who was freed, but Kearney was sent up for 6 to 10 at Walpole. John Safarian got 4 to 5 years at Walpole. Orest Luminello was given 2 years probation. I don't want to get sidetracked, but Orest is a Ukrainian name, but Luminello certainly isn't.
Okay, well, I had to look it up. Saint Orestus was a martyr in the 4th century, and both churches venerate him.
So okay.
Just had to get that in.
Okay. All right.
But as for Kearney's murder, it remains unsolved. And that brings us to John Stokes, an inmate at Walpole who was murdered there on June 14th. And my brain immediately jumped to Jimmy Flemmie because you know how Jimmy liked killing people even in prison. But Jimmy had allegedly fled the prior month, and we'll do more on Jimmy when he dies in 1979.
And in true Walpole fashion, the inmates were running the place. 4 other inmates besides Jimmy also failed to return from furlough that month. 3 of them, the authorities forgot to report, were missing. They said it was because of a breakdown in communications.
Yeah, I think that they just didn't want to admit how bad the situation was there because the prisoners were pretty much running the place.
Well, that too. The headline read, Walpole inmate who was star of TV show was found stabbed to death. A guard discovered his body during his rounds at 4:25 in the afternoon. He was serving 15 to 20 years for a September 1974 bank robbery in Northampton that netted $50,000.
But he was also waiting trial along with one Thomas Sparazza for another bank robbery in Middleton, Massachusetts that was near Richardson's Creamery that had taken place in early 1975.
Yeah.
Stokes escaped from Concord in July of 74 and was on the lam until the end of 75 when he was captured on Cape Cod at his father's home.
Stokes was the 6th inmate in 6 months to be killed in Walpole that year.
Think about that.
I'm trying not to. It was inferred by the authorities that Stokes, along with the others, were killed because they talked. Delahunt didn't deny when asked if it was a factor in what led to his murder.
Okay, so let's fast forward to October of 79 when Sparazza and Ralph Petroziello were indicted for murdering a cop named Donald Brown in May of 74 during a robbery in Roslindale that went sideways. Sparazza was still sitting in Walpole, but Ralph went on the lam with Kenneth Whiteman, who had escaped from Walpole by hiding in the prison chaplain's car 6 months previously.
That was creative. Ralph went on the air with Gary LaPierre. He phoned in from an undisclosed location to tell his tale. He told LaPierre that the cops were winning, whining and dining witnesses, and had offered one witness $25,000 to testify against him.
I'm pretty sure that was hyperbole. But Sparazza, on the other hand, confessed to killing the police officer plus 2 women with the help of Stokes. He believed Stokes was going to talk, so he killed him. The irony is, Sparazza ended up confessing on his own. He and his wife both went into witness protection program in 1980.
Let's head back to Rhode Island. Raymond Patriaca sought to have his conviction overturned because of Jack Kelly's previous testimony that he and Raymond had met at the Gaslight restaurant to iron out the details about the hit on Rudy Mafio. I hope I'm saying that right. The issue is the meeting supposedly occurred when the Gaslight was closed after a fire had nearly destroyed the place.
And while Raymond was seeking justice, the Rhode Island Attorney General opened a probe into whether any corruption had influenced the parole board's meeting in June of 74 to consider springing Raymond. That meeting ultimately made the decision to keep Raymond locked up, so the whole thing sounds like just another way for the authorities to harass Patriaca to me.
Mm-hmm.
And in November, the grand jury had to concede that they had insufficient evidence of a criminal act. Now, one of the other men convicted in the Marfio Malay double homicide was John Eugene Rossi. He met his end on November 25th of 1976. That was Thanksgiving evening, actually.
Yeah.
He had just been released 6 months earlier.
Rossi had a record going back to 1956 when he was in the service. He went AWOL in August that same year and landed in the stockades. Later, he was discharged and returned home to Providence, but trouble followed him, and within a matter of months, he was back in the can after being arrested on robbery, conspiracy charges, possession of an unlicensed weapon, and motor vehicle violations. He was sentenced to 3 years in Nina's favorite place, Howard.
I don't know if it's my favorite, but it does
sound
like...
Well, it's your favorite place to talk about. I mean, you like, kind of fun. You know, yeah, yeah. A little more interesting than Walpole.
Well... Well, anyway, I guess Rossi liked it there too, since he landed back in again in 65 on narcotics charges. But after a short stint, he was on the streets again, only to be arrested once again, this time at Robert Almonte's club in the early morning hours of April 2nd of 68, along with Louis Minacchio, Rudy Sciarra, and Dickie Calley. The crew were reportedly waiting to kill Joe Schiavone, but someone had enough foresight to call the cops on them before they committed the act.
I don't know much about Joe, but everybody was trying to kill him.
Well, certainly Louis Minacchio had it out for him.
Yeah.
But that list reads like a who's who of the organized crime in New England until Dussault pinned it on DeMasi and his bonded vault cohort, Chucky Flynn. But I still do not buy that story.
I don't buy it either. And DeMasi was in the can when it happened and didn't have the brains to tell anybody. Gee, I couldn't have killed him. You had pinched me that same day, but whatever. When the cops raided Almonte's place, they discovered that all the men were armed, but law enforcement couldn't make the charges stick, and Rossi and the others were cut loose. But Rossi's freedom was cut short after he was charged with participating in the double homicide of Maffeo and Millay as the getaway driver. Rossi was paroled in 1974, but just 3 days after Raymond was paroled on January 12th of 75, Rossi jumped bail for a new robbery charge and took it on the lam.
Well, his runner didn't last long when he was returned to prison 3 days later. But my thing is, if he was out on parole, why wasn't he remanded rather than given bail?
And how many times have we asked that question?
And how many times do we say it would have been better off staying in jail because they end up getting killed?
Too many. But in the court's defense, in those days, it's not like they had instant access to someone's records or status.
True, but reportedly Rossi's murder had nothing to do with anything mob-related. Instead, he and another man named James Farrell got into a fight in the bathroom of a bar.
You know, I'm sorry, but the whole bathroom thing in a bar, it's just...
First the rumor was that it was over a woman, but then the authorities walked that back, so maybe
it was two guys in a toilet!
Drugs?
Well, you know what I was thinking, but whatever. Okay.
I was thinking drugs because it was Johnny Rossi. Rossi's body was found 10 minutes before midnight on Thanksgiving. At first, the cops thought that it was a hit and run, but an autopsy showed that Rossi had been shot 3 times in the stomach. In addition, the North Providence police chief told the press that, quote, Rossi had a very large gash on his forehead as if he was hit with a large object, unquote. However, no such object was found in the vicinity of the crime. Initial reports indicated that Rossi had been dragged 2,400 feet by a car, but his wounds were not consistent. Quote, if he was dragged 2,400 feet, he would have been ripped to shreds. He must have gotten tangled up with the underside of the car or something.
Scary. James Farrell was arrested the following day and remanded to Howard until his bail hearing was set. With Rudy Sciarra and Robert Fairbrother still locked up at Howard, Farrell's appearance there created a riot. The residents of the maximum security section demanded that Farrell be transferred there so they could protect him.
Can you imagine the chaos? They locked down the prison for over a week as a result of the protests. Now, Farrell's younger brother was also locked up at Howard at the same time on charges of breaking and entering. Then add Jerry Wimette on conspiracy to commit murder, Richard Cochran on pending murder charges, and Romeo Gabriel on an assortment of charges. All four of them demanded that Farrell be moved to the maximum security section for his own safety.
The authorities released a statement the following day, quote, James Farrell acted alone in killing Rossi after an argument at the Drift Inn Cafe in Providence. We have interviewed many people and have talked to witnesses to certain incidents. There was no contract out on Rossi's life as far as we know, end quote. The Farrell boys were mostly into B&Es and petty stuff, although Farrell had been arrested in June of 1973 on charges of assault with intent to kill. He allegedly attacked Lawrence Samos at the same bar in December 1972.
Drugs.
Okay. Just saying. Probably.
Well, bail was set at $25,000 the following month after the state failed to show enough evidence that Farrell had killed Rossi. They did raid Farrell's home and confiscated two guns, but neither of them matched the murder weapon. John Cicilline represented Farrell. After his release on bail, Farrell took off to Pennsylvania, where in April he broke into a convent, assaulted two nuns, and stole $8,000.
What a fine, upstanding citizen he was.
Well, he pleaded guilty to those crimes in October and was sentenced there, but the authorities in Pennsylvania sent him back to Rhode Island, and the Rossi murder trial began in April of 78. Since it was Rhode Island, there were all kinds of shenanigans, including one of Farrell's brothers threatening a witness. The prosecutor claimed that Farrell had shot Rossi and run him over with his car. Rossi's dead body had then been caught in the undercarriage of the car and been dragged along the street for 2,500 feet. And they could actually, like, follow the blood trail. Anyway.
Yeah, I saw that.
Anyway, but I have questions about the mechanics of all of it, and it seems like the jury did too, because they acquitted Farrell and he was free to go. But Farrell's misadventures continued, and in March of 1980, Farrell was charged with breaking and entering in Newburyport, Massachusetts. He was found guilty in June and given a one-year suspended sentence and probation. Then, in September that same year, he was arrested again in Pennsylvania, this time after breaking into the priest's residence next to a Catholic church.
He obviously had issues with the church. Fast forward to 2005, when Farrell was indicted for possessing a firearm as a convicted felon. He was 62 years old at the time, so was given a light sentence.
Yeah, I think they should have just kept him in a can.
Well, your next story.
Okay, because I have to close out with the story of 80-year-old Farrell stealing a car from a Catholic school in Lewiston, New York, a little less than 2 years ago, and getting caught at the Niagara border.
Absolutely classic.
I do just want to add here that one of Farrell's brothers ended up getting killed in a bar fight in 1982, allegedly by a man named Leo Rossi, who was not related to Johnny Rossi, from what I could tell, but it just seemed kind of karmic in a way.
Indeed. Now for the final slaying of the year, that of Richie Castucci on December 29th, 1976. I have to say that this was the first time my eavesdropping on the conversations in the house actually shook me. I was seven, so it's more of a surprise that I hadn't already been disturbed by something I heard. Later, it was the whole Rasmussen tale after he kidnapped Dad that took place, but...
Well, let's not revisit that story. Also, ominously, a crow just, like, dove through my yard, as you were saying.
Okay, let's not get into the birds right now.
Okay, well, it felt very ominous as we were talking.
I'm glad I have the shades closed. Castucci's wife had reported him missing when he didn't return from his scheduled meeting with the Somerville crew. She told police that he left for the meeting at 10 a.m. on the morning of December 28th. He was carrying a bag with a large sum of money, reportedly $40,000 in the year.
That's what I read elsewhere, yes.
Okay. When he didn't return as promised, she went to the police. His vehicle was spotted by an acquaintance of Castucci's the following day, parked between the Squire and the Northgate Mall. Inside of the trunk, his body with a single bullet to the head was stuffed in a blood-soaked blue sleeping bag.
The owner of the Squire Lounge and the infamous Ebtide, amongst others, had a record mostly of gambling charges. Like Fat Vinnie Teresa, he was involved in the gambling junkets to London, specifically with Joseph Napolitano, who will be the focus of an upcoming episode. The two were arrested, along with Rocco Botta, in London in May of 69. They walked away with a slap on the wrist and fines ranging from $4,800 to $7,200.
He definitely had a good head for business and had multiple real estate transactions and income streams going at any given time, but he still ended up in debt. And not just to any loan shark or wise guy, but to Whitey Bulger and company.
So shortly after Castucci's murder, an informant, who I believe was Stevie Fleming,
All right, so let's clarify that in the 302, the informant number was replaced with BST1. Sometimes we can find a key code that exposes the actual informant number, but not in this case. I didn't mean to cut you off, sorry.
No, it's okay. It's better to explain how this works. So this is from the Patriarcha Papers, and there are a lot of redactions in the text, so I'll just summarize it here. So in late January and early February of 77, so the month after, the months following Kisucci's murder, mm-hmm. BST1, who, as I said earlier, I think is Stevie Fleming, told his handler that Winter Hill had approached Kisucci's widow, Sandra, looking for money. More money, actually.
Yeah.
According to him, Kisucci had borrowed money from Winter Hill and had given up some percentage of the Esquire in exchange. So Stevie claimed that Sandra Kisucci contacted him to arrange a meeting with Patriarcha to mediate. Patriarcha reportedly told Stevie that he thought $40,000 would be a fair price for Sandra to pay off Winter Hill. Kisucci had been paying $500 a week on the loan for over 2 years.
So the original $40,000 that they killed him for basically just wasn't enough, so they needed another $40,000.
I mean, that's my interpretation, yes.
Okay. 302 matches Sandra's later testimony in court. She stated that her husband was going to meet Howie Winter the afternoon he was killed and never returned. Then Stevie showed up at her house and told her they wanted the Squire. Sometime later, she claims that she was summoned to Providence and Raymond told her that he was taking over the business since Kisucci owed him money.
Well, a mostly perfect match. Obviously, Stevie wasn't going to cop to harassing a grieving widow.
No comment. And there was little more of on a couple of pages about this, too, that I want to go through. So they said, quote, Kisucci owned approximately 40% of the shares of the Squire, but it sold a portion to Redacted. And Julo told somebody that $50,000 would be a fair price to pay to Winter Hill for their share of the Squire, end quote.
So years later, during Johnny Modorano's plea agreement testimony, he described his role in Kisucci's death as the trigger man.
And let's not go through his somewhat awful testimony.
I'm squeamish. Okay, so let's circle back around to Joe Mack and Jimmy Sims then. At Zip Connolly's 2008 trial, FBI Special Agent Tom Daley testified that Kisucci was his informant and had given him the location in New York City where Joe Mack and Jimmy Sims were hiding in 1976 after Joe Mack had killed Lundgren in California earlier that year. But that story doesn't make a lot of sense because supposedly it was another FBI informant, Jack Mace, who was helping the two Lannisters hide out, and Mack and Sims both managed to stay out of the clutches of law enforcement for another 6 years.
Hello.
Sims was arrested in Key West in July of 82, and Joe Mack was picked up 2 months after that on a trip to New York. And we'll be telling that story in future episodes when we do Highlight. I think that's probably when we'll hit that.
Yeah. Daley also claimed that the real reason Kisucci had been killed was because he'd been cheating on the horse races. But Johnny and Stevie had stated that Whitey told them Connolly said Kisucci was a rat and that's why they killed him, which is the only thing that really makes sense. The feds lied to Kisucci in 1970 and said his wife was having an affair with Salvatore Caruana, who will also have his own episode a little bit later in the year, and somehow twisted Kisucci up to become an informant by preying on some sense of loyalty that Kisucci supposedly felt for the feds telling him about the alleged affair. By 1971, he was listed as a TE informant in the documents that get released later. None of this came to light until decades after when the family filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the feds. His widow denied the affair under oath and always maintained that it was a lie, and I believe her, and none of that story makes any sense.
Well, I believe her too, and I don't buy what Stevie Fleming and Johnny Modorano claimed at all. If they really believed Kisucci was a rat, Stevie would have gone crying to Jerry and Raymond to justify it. Instead, they were the first ones in the door laying claim to Kisucci's property. And why would Whitey kill to protect Joe Mack? That makes no sense. This is the same stupid story they try to tell every time, playing up the stupid loyalty thing. Give me a break. No honor amongst thieves. I still say that.
And you know this was intel laundering. I don't care what anyone 100%, says.
100%. But we'll do more on that when we get into the wiretaps and all of that.
Okay.
In the 80s. Okay. What does make sense is that Howie Winter had tried to buy the Squire in 1975 and Castucci outbid him. Winter Hill wanted Castucci's stuff and they killed him for it.
Good old-fashioned greed.
They're like the school bully who beats you up for your lunch money and then goes crying to the teacher, making you be the bad guy in the story. He made me do it.
Or the abusive husband, you know, that says, oh, she drove me to it.
As for the Boston field office, forgive me, but you can't hate these people enough. They allegedly flipped Castucci by lying to him about his wife, and then they threw him under the bus because he was blocking Winter Hill's expansion. And that's the part that makes,
so sickening. And it makes it the most sickening of all.
And Patriarca was very aware of that because he commented on it at the meeting, at the end of that meeting with Stevie. Quote, Patriarca expressed his concern over the strength of the Irish group in the Boston area and indicated that it was his belief that the Irish were responsible for Castucci's death.
Hello, and the FBI did nothing to help the local cops investigate Castucci's murder. And there will be more about the Boston FBI field office in this season and next season.
I do just want to add Special Agent Daly's quip from the 2008 trial about Johnny and Stevie, and then I'll get off my soapbox, I promise.
Okay.
Quote, I wouldn't trust what they say as far as I could throw this building, unquote.
I mean, talk about the pot calling the kettle black, because you couldn't trust anything that the feds had said, and you couldn't trust anything that those idiots, so I'm going to call them whatever, said, because they had the same script.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Enough of all of that. So we will be back next week with the Nikki Bianco trial. And
then the Napolitano, right? And you'll get to hear more of my rants about Zip Connolly getting people killed.
Oh, we're almost into the 80s.
And not if we don't stop talking. I think we went long again. So much for our promises.
I know. Okay. All right. Thanks everyone for listening. Bye.
Bye.